Thank you for joining us. On this edition of Homefront, we talk with two experts on children in middle school. One of them is even taking a few moments out of her middle school classroom to join us. We talk about ADHD, cutting, computers, and what it's like to be in the pampered generation. I hope you enjoy our show. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Welcome to Homefront. Today we have two ladies who are on the forefront of the battle to raise our children. We have Cynthia Tobias, who's a successful, amazing woman and has had a huge impact on the country with many of her daily moments you may have heard on the radio. She has also had 8 years of teaching high school and 6 years in law enforcement. So you're from Washington State. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Cynthia.
And we also have Sue Acuna. Sue is the mother of three sons and has taught middle school for over 20 years and has a very popular blog called MrsAcuna.wordpress.com. So welcome, Sue.
Thank you. Yes, I'm actually going to be teaching later today.
Oh, fantastic. Well, let me tell you, I loved your book. When I first started reading it, it resonated so much with what my direct experience has been personally. Seventh grade was the worst year of my life. And when you talk about all the foibles of middle school, they're very relatable. I remember it clearly. What made both of you decide to focus just on middle school when you consider all the awfulness that can happen to a child in their entire upbringing? Why is middle school such an important place to marquee our lives?
You know, Cynthia, I think it's because of what you said. Most of us remember seventh grade as being very difficult. And yet, when I work with kids, I love them. I mean, I enjoy their passion and their enthusiasm. And I would like their parents to know how much I enjoy them and what techniques work with me to get along with them and to motivate them and, you know, to get them doing things that they might not want to do.
And one of my big motivators was when my boys were in junior high and getting ready to go into high school, a friend of mine was the junior high principal there, and he said one morning, he said, I wish that there was some way to tell parents how important it is before kids get to high school in these critical middle school and junior high years to not just throw up their hands and hope they can survive, but they need a relationship with their child that's only going to be able to be forged during these years. And he said if they wait until high school, a lot of it will be too late. And that really stuck with me even years ago and thinking about, you know, how often we wish, oh, just wait for it to be over. And yet we are wasting some incredibly valuable time in the forging of a relationship and in the wet cement that these kids still are.
They are exactly wet cement. I want to tell you a story of my own seventh grade year. My parents moved me from Chicago to Boston that year, and I thought the people in Boston would be as friendly as the people in the Midwest. I was in for a big jolt. And then I went to school, and I blame the school teachers. I'm sorry. I know you're both school teachers, but let me tell you, when they instruct the students to pair off, especially for science, get a lab partner, or locker, go get a locker mate. Do you know how uncomfortable that was for me being the new kid and having all that stress of, I don't know who wants to be my locker mate. And then coupled with the rejection of me asking people, would you like to be my lab partner? Would you like to be my locker mate? And having to be confronted with no. And then let me tell you about the lunchroom. Of course, they let us sit anywhere we wanted. So I would sit down at a table with other girls, and they would all get up and move to another table. And I thought, my life is over. I am trash. This is the end. Nobody likes me. I am totally done. And for good reason. I had valid scientific proof. And yet I couldn't find an adult to mend my pain. All I had to deal with is, apparently, this is my orientation in life now. People don't like me. I don't know why they don't like me, but the reality is they don't like me. And I know in your book, you talk a little bit about this. Share with us, what is the right answer and what can people do to make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, I have to say, I think you are right when you say you kind of blame the teachers. As a teacher of students of that age, when there are no students around, I always go to a group of particularly friendly, you know, it's always tougher for girls, but I'll go to a group of particularly friendly kids and say, would you be sure she's invited? Would you be sure she's excluded? Because one of the things we talk about is how middle schoolers live in a bubble and they're not thinking about others. And so, you know, the whole not being asked to be a lab partner, that comes partly from, I'm going to go to my friend and I'm not even going to think about the new girl. And then the rejection part also comes from, well, I'm not thinking about how much you need a friend. I'm thinking about how much I want to be with a friend. So just to point out to the other kids, look, there's somebody new. We need to pull that person into the circle. That's a huge responsibility that I think adults need to step up and take.
And, of course, one of the big advantages of reading this book and even writing this book was being able to reach out to parents as well to recognize how you can spot it and what you can do about it and how you can at least ease some of your child's pain, not that you can make it go away, because it's a lot of it is the natural development part of puberty and pre-adolescence. But there's a lot you can do as a parent to help your child feel less bad during this really critical time.
Well, how I solved it is I left the campus of the school. And I knew, I don't endorse this for other people, but I found it more tolerable to take a walk for a half hour and come back to school, even if it meant I wasn't going to eat lunch, than the stress of having to confront the lunch tables. And what do we do if I sit down and everybody else gets up and leaves? And, you know, when you think about it, it's amazing that nobody cared. I didn't even have adults who noticed or cared that I left the school.
I know, sad but true, isn't it? And that's not uncommon.
Well, I love you. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and look at how many years later, even listening to you talk about it, we can hear the pain is still fresh, because that pain of rejection is so hard. And do you remember joining anything? Because I know one way for new kids or kids who aren't making connections to help fit in is for them to become a part of something outside of the classroom. So to be, you know, a part of the yearbook staff, or to play a sport, or if you're not talented in sports, to be in a music group, because there are bonds that form there.
Well, my mom and dad took me to church, and even though that was nice, it was in the next community over, and there were no church kids who went to my school. So I was an island. And at this point, I obviously, you know, I'm 54. And so this was going back 40 years ago, more than that. And yet we dealt with what we had to deal with. The feelings are the same no matter what your age. The emotions and the way people behave. Don't think that the world used to be a nicer place, because it didn't. But God says people have always had evil in their hearts. And I just chalk it up to maybe the Lord wanted me to learn some lessons about Him. I want to talk about the technical issues in your book. You call it technical issues. I love that. When we were all kids, the internet hadn't been invented yet. Cell phones hadn't been invented yet. And we didn't have all these mindless distractions and external negative influences. When I had a bad day at school, I came home one day and told my brother I had a bad day. This is how technology worked back then. He went over to our stereo and put on a record of Alice Cooper singing "School's Out for Summer." And you know, the last line of it is, "School's been blown to pieces."
Which made you feel better.
That was before school shootings happened. It did make me feel better, but that was the limit of technology back then. Now, we come home and find our kids on computers. Many of them in middle school have cell phones. We have websites like Pinger where you can text people even if you don't have a cell phone, if you have a computer, and then everybody thinks you have a cell phone. We have Tumblr, we have Snapchat, we've got kids taking selfies. The word selfie hadn't been invented back then. If we had a film camera and wanted to wait a week to see what, spend our money seeing what we look like to get that developed, fine, but that was unheard of. I went on my daughter's Tumblr account. Now, you get into asking for passwords. I love the idea of parents having passwords, but there is this idea among middle school children that that's their privacy. They have a right to privacy. And you handle privacy very delicately in the book. But if you can share with us what the limits are, even when I did have a password, I went on Tumblr and what I found there was like pornography. It was kids showing their body parts. It was kids physically cutting themselves and filming themselves cutting themselves. I was aghast. I was offended. And I, even though I had a password, I didn't know what to do with it. Can you give us some guidance for those who are confronted with this and don't know what to do?
Cynthia, first I say kudos to you for even knowing about Tumblr and for getting on and taking a look at it. Because both Cynthia Tobias and I are frustrated by parents who say, oh, I don't even know what they do on that thing. I don't even know how to open that thing. And we say, you know, never have electronics that you can't use. And your kids should not have accounts that you're not familiar with. So for you to be on there, that's good parenting right there. I would bring my child to the screen and say, wow, this is what I'm looking at. What are your feelings about this? And let them, you know, express either, well, I don't like it either, but I just don't look at that stuff, or I didn't even know that was there, or I hardly ever go on that anymore. And I would manipulate the conversation and try and guide it around to get the child's agreement that maybe this is not maybe, that this is not healthy things to be looking at, that this is not conducive to a Christ-centered life, and to close the account. If you can't get them to agree to that, you may need to be just a little more forceful and say, well, you know what, let's find something else. Not this, but something else. I'm afraid I'm just going to have to put my foot down.
And to remember, too, in middle school especially, there really is no reasonable expectation of a great deal of privacy. Some privacy, yes, as they're learning, but this is a privilege that they have to be on the internet and to have some of these, especially if it's a phone. And Sue and I both very much advocate that they never have a computer in their room. When they're on the online like that, they should be out in a public area with the rest of the family, in a living room, in a family room, so that if something pops up on the screen, you'll be able to spot it. For me, with my boys, you know, I wouldn't even allow that, certainly at the 13 and 14 age level or the middle school level. I wouldn't even allow the Tumblr account because of the boundaries and because we know what it is. And that again, like Sue says, that's a smart, savvy parent who figures out, wait a minute, if you want to have a Facebook account, that's one thing, and I can get on it, be a Facebook friend, I can monitor what's going on. But if there's something that's obviously out of bounds for these older kids, that's it. And you have to be able to be firm and be polite. And you know, you can politely say, look, the bottom line is your safety. That's my first concern, your safety. And this is what we're going to do. And so, you know, we can do it unapologetically and in a friendly way. But to say, as you get older, we'll deal with it in different ways. But at this point, this is the way it is.
And let me share a humorous irony with you. My life changed when somebody taught me this trick that you can click Control H and see the history of what websites your child has been to. Well, The problem is these kids think they're smarter than us. Somebody told my daughter how to go incognito, which is working around. Right. If you go incognito, then your parents can't search your history because it doesn't show up.
Yeah. That's when you want to invest in some kind of software like NetNanny, which allows you to see where the kids have been. They cannot delete it. And it can also let you on in real time. So I know parents who are at work while their kids are home, and they will just log on, and they actually will see whatever it is the kids are seeing on their screen. To me, if you have kids that are online and unmonitored, that is certainly worth investigating.
And it's being online where they learn all these tricks of how to go incognito and learn how to cut, which is another interesting topic you deal with briefly in your book. I own a Christian bookstore. I sell homeschool curriculum. I actually had parents come in my bookstore looking for homeschool curriculum because they're taking their child out of public school. The reason they did is because when they talked to the guidance counselor about the fact that their daughter was cutting, she laughed and said, everybody's cutting, it's no big deal. And if that's the attitude we're going to have, we've got serious problems. Now, for those of you who don't know what cutting is, if I handed you a razor blade and said, would you like to cut yourself? I mean, you'd think, no. It's easy to not want to cut yourself. However, can you explain to us why this phenomenon has taken over and kids have some desire now to cut? Is it something cool that they're doing? Do they like having scars? And is it like a tattoo before you can get a tattoo?
When I first encountered cutting, I was in a panic because I thought this student was suicidal, and that's what a lot of parents think. What I've learned about it is it for most kids, it's a troubled child who's experiencing a lot of pain, and they want to bring that inside pain out. And by dealing with the physical pain of, and as much as cutting, sometimes they'll take pins and actually poke themselves. That actually helps release the inside pain. So my first thought with a child who's cutting is, oh, it's not ha-ha, everybody's doing it. It's here's a child who needs some extra help, some counseling. What the students have told me is sometimes people will sit around, and just like other middle school things, they will bear each other, but the behavior can actually become addictive. There's actually kind of a hypnotic thing that can happen, and it can become addictive. And so I have had girls who have done it warn other girls, don't ever start, because once you start, it's hard to stop. So I think it's one of those things that we don't warn kids about enough. And that's always a tricky issue. By warning them, are we teaching them how? But I think it's ignorance. It's like, oh yeah, why not? It's something fun to do, and kids have no grasp of the significance or the danger.
Which brings up, and that's important, we talk a little bit about in the book about filtering. You know, your kids, especially at middle school, when they hear the news or they hear kids talk about cutting or they hear kids talk about depression and other things, if we as parents don't confront that issue and talk to them about it, they're only going to get their information from their peers, and it's going to come to them through a filter that may very well not be certainly not our biblical worldview, and certainly not a filter that we would want them. We want to at least be involved in getting the information to them, because they're going to Google it, and they're going to talk to their friends. So as much as we don't want to deal with it, it really is important that we figure out more about it and talk to them.
How about ADHD? I had a foster child in my home who was in middle school, and he, during that time, was diagnosed with ADHD. It is such a growing phenomenon, but I don't know why. Can you explain, either of you, from your educator's perspective, what is going on that so many children now have ADHD?
Yeah, we do. And I was just going to quickly say, and then I'll let Cindy talk because she's done more research on this. But if we could answer that question, we would be multimillionaires. We would be on the lecture circuit. We don't really know why it seems to be happening more.
And I think one of the big reasons, Cynthia, that there's such a big ADHD type thing, I'm not sure that we've actually defined what's normal. It seems like we've figured out, well, maybe even really young kids are supposed to sit still and be quiet and pay attention. And one of the ADHD tests is how how well you can pay attention during boring, tedious tasks. And if that's the case, then we all have ADD and to some extent. And so I think it's important to figure out how much is really a learning disability and how much is more a learning style or more because I'm bored or because I'm not interested in this particular thing. It's way too easy sometimes for parents or teachers to say, if you could just give the kid something that'll calm him down, then we can teach him better. But the fact is that sets a dangerous precedent for the rest of their lives, and it's not necessarily going to achieve the goal of learning. It's just going to achieve the goal of making them pay better attention to you. But I think we sometimes miss the point, and I think we have to be careful of the ADD. And it's not that there aren't legitimate learning disabilities, but I think this one's way overused, and I think that we have to really consider how much of this is still just part of their personality and how quickly do we want to medicate. That's my worry.
We talked earlier about screens and how much kids are on their phones and on the computer, and the world is changing. And personally, as an educator, I think the classroom needs to change too. I'm not saying we necessarily need more screens, but we need to look at how kids are getting their information. And so if they're getting it in small bites, and this goes way back to, the Sesame Street syndrome, if they're getting it in small bites and it's very active and it's very engaging, we only put them in a classroom and say, sit still, be quiet, and listen while I teach you something, we can't expect that they're going to be as involved.
They get it in short, bite-sized pieces. That's the culture today. The culture is short, bite-sized pieces. And we can either fight that and say, you've got to learn to do it differently, or we can figure out, how do we use it to fit their strengths, and how do we still get the learning across? Because the bottom line is still the bottom line, accountability and learning. But we have to ask ourselves, what's the point? Is the point that they have to sit still for 30 minutes without moving, or is the point that they get the homework done, even if they have to take a couple breaks or move in order to do it? And that's where we come into how much is normal and how much is for our convenience versus what really works for the child.
The problem is when they're in elementary school, they're so much younger that people assume that's childishness. And then when they get to middle school, there's so much more expected of them that it becomes more obvious if they are not going to settle down and buckle down and learn. And the question is, how can children with ADHD become productive members of society and launch successfully in a career field if nobody is educating them?
Well, one of the biggest things we have to educate them is what their strengths are. For instance, if you're a highly restless, active, kinesthetic kid, you're probably not going to want to be looking at the field of accounting or computer science, where all you're going to do is sit behind the computer. You need to figure out, what's going to match the gifts that God gave me in the first place? What's going to keep me happy and productive, rather than trying to force myself into a position that's only going to make me miserable? And that's part of the growth process, is figuring out, what are my strengths and how can I use them to succeed in school and to figure out how to succeed in life?
One of the problems I see with public school is they have so many children in a classroom. Not every parent can afford to put their children in Montessori school, and not every parent can homeschool. Obviously, that would be ideal for children who have special learning needs, but it seems like the typical public school answer is deny them of recess if they don't get their work done and keep them in. Well, for children who have ADHD, that's about the worst strategy you could implement. What would you do in your classrooms if you had a student with ADHD and you just had too many other kids?
As much as it's hard as a teacher, because especially in the public schools, you've got a certain curriculum that you have to teach by a certain time. And so they're kind of hamstrung as to how they're going to get through it all and keep all the kids' attention. To me, if you can incorporate as much activity as possible, that ADHD kid is often the one who is the most entertaining. And so to even say, can you come up here and act this out for us, or allow children to stand up in the back of the classroom for a moment, or Cynthia really advocates taking more frequent breaks. When we teach adults, we never make them sit, you know, for very long without taking some kind of a break. And it doesn't have to be a get up and leave the classroom recess break, even just to turn to the person and talk to you. We talk a lot about, you know, classroom management skills. When you've got really active kids, you either fight it or you make it work for you. And so instead of sitting there working on a worksheet about a topic, it might be better to get up and move around somehow about that topic.
And sometimes it's interesting because awareness is half the battle. Sometimes just your recognizing it helps that kid feel better, whether you're the parent or the teacher, to say, I know this is hard for you, isn't it, because you're pretty restless. If you can hang on for a couple more minutes, there'll be a chance for you to at least get a tiny little break. And so then sometimes, a lot of times, the kid goes, oh, good, you know it's going to drive me crazy, and you recognize that I'm really frustrated. And then the frustration level goes down because you recognize and you teach them to recognize it. And you say, I wish we could do this differently. I know that you wish, I know that you want to not be here, but if you could hang on. And just, you know, pulling it up to the awareness level helps to teach the kid, too, about taking some responsibility for their own learning and living and learning about life, that life isn't going to exactly accommodate you all the time either. But you can recognize it, and you can realize it's not because I'm dumb, and it's not because there's something wrong with me. It's because this is just not a situation that fits me. How can I get past it? How can I succeed?
This seems to be the most pampered generation our country has ever seen. They're used to being driven places. They're going to play soccer and ballet, and parents are run ragged trying to accommodate their children. They're being transported. When I was a child, I don't know about you ladies, but my parents gave me a bicycle and said, if you want to go anywhere, here's the bike. Now, you know, it's dangerous in many places to allow your child to ride a bicycle. They could be abducted or run over. And because of that, we've tended to coddle our children, and we've raised the standard of pampering and taking care of them, nurturing. I don't know that it's helping them. It seems like they're in longer cocoons. Even, you know, with the Obamacare program, they said children can be on their parents' medical insurance policies till they're 26, even if they're married. Because I think that's an acknowledgement that delayed adolescence is a fact, that people are not growing up quicker, they're growing up slower. And yet at the same time, we're not getting stronger character. What do you recommend for how to deal with all these situations so that mom and dad will stay on par with their neighbors?
Tell her the chapstick mom example.
Well, we share your frustration, Cynthia, with parents who coddle their children. I had a student a couple of years ago who had gotten to school and realized she had forgotten her chapstick. And she called her mom and said, Mom, I really need you to bring me my chapstick. Now, she didn't have a cold or any reason that medical reason that she needed it. She just really wanted it. And her mom hopped in the car. She lived 10 miles away because it's a you know, private school. Kids come from all over the place. She hopped in her car and drove to school just to deliver her daughter's chapstick. And that's what we consider an extreme form of helicopter parenting. And I find that parents kind of expect that their kids are going to wake up at 18 or 21 and suddenly be an adult and be independent. And you and I know that's not the case. You have to teach them as they go. We like to say you have to relax your grip. You can't steer for them all the time. You have to just sort of guide them. And I like to remind parents, don't give in now to give something to your kids and sacrifice what you ultimately want for them, which is to be an independent, responsible adult.
And watch, you know, the small rescues can maybe go, you know, can go unrescued, whereas the larger ones maybe can't, but there still has to be an awareness. I give an example of Robert, one of my sons, who I think it was 7th, 8th grade, he had forgotten his project, and it was a really important project. He got all the way to school, and he called me, and he was in a panic and said, I really forgot my project, and I really have to have it. And I said, well, Rob, I'll come bring it to you, but I'm going to charge you $1 for gas each way out of your allowance, because this is something you should have remembered, and it's really going to cut into my day. And so are you willing to do that? And he said, oh, okay. And, you know, it was a lot of for at that time, it was, you know, a pretty big chunk of his allowance. And later, after I came up, and he, you know, he paid me his $2 in order to bring that science project. And we talked about it later in the evening, and I said, there are probably other ways you'd rather spend that $2, right? And he goes, yeah. And, you know, he didn't forget his science project or any project again the rest of the year, because before he called me, he would think, uh-oh, wait, it's going to cost me money. I think I better figure out a different way. And I think if we can at least turn it into lessons, and there are times when you can rescue your child, obviously, but bringing chapstick, you know, 10-mile round trip to bring a chapstick, that's a small rescue. And if you do have to do it, I'm going to charge more money for it, or make it some kind of responsibility, so that we don't just have the entitlement idea that, oh, well, it's okay, because if I forget it, my mom will just bring it to me. We shouldn't be afraid of discipline. We shouldn't certainly do it out of anger. There does have to be a consequence for misbehavior, and there has to be a clear boundary. And that's difficult for parents. I'm, you know, one of the things that Sue runs into all the time are parents who are actually afraid to discipline because of the reaction of their kids.
And I find that comes back more to what we were saying earlier about that coddling and that entitlement. I've had parents say, I don't want to do that. I don't want to take her phone away because it'll just make her mad. And parents are afraid to discipline their children for making them angry. And I think, you know, discipline is to me much more important than punishment. Some parents think if they issue a consequence and the child doesn't get angry, it's not tough enough. Other parents are afraid to do that for fear their kids are getting angry. Cynthia tells a wonderful example of how the policeman simply walks up to your car when you've been speeding and hands you a ticket. He doesn't have to stand there and yell and berate you because you know that it's wrong and you're not happy about it, but that's the way it is. If more parents could issue more tickets calmly and say, this is what you did, this is the consequence, and this is what I want you to learn. There's got to be a point to the discipline, to the consequence.
That's good. So, Cynthia, I'd like you to wrap this up with the one final statement you want people to know about middle school, the inside story.
Well, if I could only say one thing, I would say, remember, they still need you as parents. They will always need you. How they need you changes, and it will always change. But one of the things that really impressed me in talking to these kids and spending the last couple of years just immersed in middle school is the hearts of the child at 12 to 14, they're still longing to have their parents. They don't want them in the same way, but they do still love you, and they desperately need your love and support.
That's beautiful. And Sue, what is your wrap-up statement? If there's one takeaway from this whole talk today, what do you want them to remember?
I think it's important for parents and middle schoolers to remember that they need to stay connected, that there are two things that that child should always be able to count on, and one is their love from you, and the idea that God loves them. Should never damage a relationship so much that a child does not feel loved by both a parent and by their Lord.
That's beautiful. So if people want to contact you, they need to go to Cynthia's website is cynthiatobias.com. And Sue Acuna's website is mrsacuna.wordpress.com. You both have been lovely. I thank you for sharing these insights. I believe it will make an impact on people all over the country. Thank you for writing your book, and we'll look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, well, you've been a blessing. We'll let you get back to class now. This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.